This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. More than a month ago, the Trump administration removed hundreds of migrants from the United States, accusing them of engaging in gang activity. They were sent to El Salvador by plane, despite a court order not to do that. One of the people sent there was Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Salvadoran citizen with legal status in the U.S. The administration says it deported him by mistake. Nevertheless, they now say there's nothing they can do to bring Garcia back to the United States. He and hundreds of other migrants to the U.S. have now been locked up in El Salvador without due process or any timeline for trial or release. Many of them are in a notorious prison known as CECOT, though Garcia has reportedly been transferred to a lower security facility. It is, to say the least, a significant departure from previous policy on immigration in the United States, and that's just one among many changes.
The Trump administration's crackdown on immigration is impacting visa and green card holders, and in some cases, tourists.
A federal judge in Massachusetts on Friday blocked the government from deporting a Tufts University graduate student who was arrested last week by immigration officers and had her visa revoked.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ordered the Trump administration not to deport a group of Venezuelan migrants accused of being gang members.
For the rest of the hour, we're talking about how all this has been affecting immigrant communities here in Illinois and trying to make sense of what's happening in El Salvador as well. With me to talk about this is Charlotte Alvarez, Executive Director of the Immigration Project in Bloomington Normal. Charlotte, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
Adriana Cardona Magidad is immigration reporter at WBEZ Chicago Public Radio. Adriana, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Also joining us, Fred Sow, Senior Policy Counsel for the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Fred, welcome to you.
Thanks, Brian. Always good to be on this program, and always good to hear Father Chuck as well.
Great. And Miranda Hallett is Associate Professor of Cultural Anthropology and Director of Human Rights Studies at the University of Dayton in Ohio. Her work focuses on El Salvador as well as U.S. immigration enforcement. Miranda, thank you for being with us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can join us throughout the hour by calling 800-222-9455. What do you think of the way immigrants and immigration in general has been handled under the second Trump administration? How is our immigration policy shaping up in your view? And especially if you are an immigrant or if you know someone who's an immigrant and you're willing to speak out, how are you doing right now? 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. Adriana, I'm going to start with you. Broadly speaking, how would you describe what has changed in the last 3 months in the federal approach to immigration?
Well, I definitely think, or I've been, you know, reporting, it's been a lot more punitive. It's been criminalizing immigrants who are either caught up in a difficult system to navigate, as it is in the case of Venezuelans seeking asylum, and the confusions around, you know, who qualifies and how hard it is to get asylum in the country. And also those who have spoken up and shared their views, most recently among, you know, the international students and the legal permanent residents who were involved in efforts to, you know, to show their support for, you know, the war in Palestine. And while immigrant experts say the U.S. government has deported, you know, immigrants to countries other than their own in the past, this time is, you know, this is the first time, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that immigrants or migrants are being sent to a maximum security prison in El Salvador. And it's an attempt to, like you said earlier in your introduction, to crack down on immigration, to show the numbers that, you know, that people are getting deported, that the bad guys, but to what extent, you know, is the government offering enough evidence that people are connected to terrorist gangs, gang organizations, and in many cases to get to those numbers that are being promised. The government right now is bypassing a lot of legal protocols, including, you know, judicial warrants before arresting immigrants in their homes and other private spaces.
How is that affecting people in the communities you cover, Adriana?
Well, I mean, as I interview people and just talk to people in general, you know, immigrants, migrants, long-term immigrants, and people who just arrived here, They're living in fear, dropping their kids to school in fear, driving in fear, going to immigration appointments in a lot of fear. Some people don't even know where to start planning in case, like, let's say their asylum application gets denied. Do we quickly leave the country? Do we figure out a plan? And even for those who have a current pending application, it's really uncertain too. That application can get denied or terminated. And, you know, how do you plan for that? And I think people are having to make really tough decisions as to, do we leave before anything even gets settled so that we can stay together? Or do we risk the chance of, you know, of being separated?
Fred Tsao with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. We spoke on the program before the election, mm-hmm. I think, last year. You know, what's that meme that people say on the internet? How it's going now, or how it started, how it's going? How does this compare to what people were expecting going into this administration?
Well, Brian, I think many of the things that we are seeing now, we fully anticipated in large part because the previous version of this administration tried these things before. I think what's different this time is that they're trying to do this at a much faster pace. They're trying to accelerate the pace of operations, the pace of deportations. They are being much more aggressive with respect to their posturing in the courts, and they are weaponizing their communication strategies. I don't recall last time around the Homeland Security Secretary creating YouTube videos to try to scare people into self-deporting. At the same time, we're also seeing, as we've already discussed, attempts to kind of, circumvent a lot of the ordinary processes. The self-deportation move is one such move. The emergency declarations, the use of the Alien Enemies Act are part of a piece of this. They may have come to the realization that the immigration courts are very, very badly backlogged. In fact, the president said a couple of days ago that he'd like to deport as many people without giving them due process, without giving them their day in court. Interestingly enough, rather than ramping up immigration court capacity, they're actually firing immigration judges. Basically, they're stacking up more hay on the haystack and taking away the pitchforks. We're seeing all of this happening. Stuff that we saw before, but put on steroids.
Charlotte Alvarez, your organization, the Immigration Project, is explicitly in the mission. It's meant to provide legal services to people in central and southern Illinois, to immigrants. How do you keep up with everything that's been going on?
Yes, I'll echo. I 100% agree with what Fred was saying. It's just the pace of change is turbocharged. And we meet with so many people who are just looking for safety and security and stability. And that looking for going through the legal processes and pathways in order to put forth a claim for asylum, in order to become a U.S. citizen, or in order to become a permanent resident. And the pace of change has been astronomical. Which means the law is so unsettled. So we'll meet with someone and explain what their legal rights and options are, and then that whole framework might be taken out from underneath them. So that has been a challenge. We have a rapid response team. We have a set of team members across the state who are monitoring situation on the ground, and then coordinating a national efforts to understand what's happening at the national effort to create the policies in our team, and then explain that to individuals in both information and then legal consultations and advice in order to give people the most accurate, up-to-date legal information that we can so that they can make those tough decisions. I'll give you an example of that. There was a rescission of parole for individuals from Haiti, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. And so we had individuals who thought that they had parole and therefore permission to remain and work authorization.
And maybe we should pause on exactly what that means, because parole, I think that conjures up the ideas of criminality for people and getting out of prison. But that's not what it means in this context, right?
Maybe no, in this context.
Explain that. Yeah.
Yes. So some individuals came into the United States under a program that was created by the federal government to allow reunification of families to, especially, for example, we have Haitian communities in Illinois. Haiti is going through a period of mass instability. And so individuals have applied through this program and been granted permission to come and be allowed to remain temporarily in the United States to give safety and stability during that time. It is not related in any way to any criminal records. And actually, there is vetting to ensure that individuals don't have specific criminal records in order to get that parole. So we have people who had this permission, were granted permission to be here because of this program. And then that is kind of pulled out from under their feet. We have individuals who are getting notices saying, you have to leave the country in 7 days. And can you imagine for yourself getting such a notice and then needing to understand what are the rights and options available? You know, is that something that needs to be complied with? Do they have potentially an asylum claim that causes them to have fear to return to their country? All of that needs to be sorted out in careful analysis. And we're trying to do as much of that as quickly as we can.
It's the 21st show. We are talking for the rest of the program today about immigration and what the consequences have been in Illinois and beyond of the second Trump administration's purported crackdown on immigration, which has included everything from arresting college students off the street, sending them to a detention center in Louisiana, to rounding people up and without apparent due process, sending them to a notorious anti-terrorism prison in El Salvador. My guests for this conversation are Charlotte Alvarez, who's with the Immigration Project, which serves immigrant communities in downstate Illinois, Fred Sau, Senior Policy Counsel at the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, Adriana Cardona-Maguidad, immigration reporter at WBEZ in Chicago, and Miranda Hallett from the University of Dayton, where she's Director of Human Rights Studies. Miranda, I want to spend some time on this point of this CECOT prison, as it's known. Why El Salvador?
Yes, thank you. Well, some of your listeners might recall that a couple of months ago at the beginning of February, Secretary of State Marco Rubio was visiting El Salvador and on his first overseas tour. And President Bukele of El Salvador at the time said to him that El Salvador offered to incarcerate people in their prisons on behalf of the United States. And the explicit offer was actually not only migrants, but anybody, including U.S. citizens that the United States wanted to send elsewhere. Rubio at the time called this an act of extraordinary friendship. Bukele said in a post on X that he had offered the U.S., quote, the opportunity to outsource part of its prison system. I think, you know, that Bukele did this partly because he has already shown himself very much willing to flout human rights and the rule of law. He has already suspended due process and constitutional rights in El Salvador for Salvadoran citizens. And that was made possible by the consolidation of unchecked executive power over the last couple of years. So if I may, I'd just like to kind of lay out the timeline because I think it's important. In early 2020, Bukele sent in the military to occupy the Legislative Assembly and essentially threaten lawmakers to pass his budget. Following that, he gerrymandered the country so that he could win a supermajority in Congress. The first day that supermajority came in May 2021, they removed the Supreme Court and the Attorney General, who at the time had been investigating Bukele for corruption and for allying with high-level gang members, actually, behind the scenes. And in March 2022, finally, Bukele declared this state of emergency and suspended completely the constitutional right to due process for anybody who is arrested by the government. And that allegedly temporary state of emergency has persisted to this day. So if you do the math, we're going into the fourth year now of this situation. In the meantime, he's attacked the media, human rights organizations. He's undermined the legitimacy of universities and any other possible kind of site of opposition to his seizure of power. And what that's led to on the ground for the people that I know best, which is just ordinary Salvadorans living in their communities, is a situation very similar to what they faced in the 1980s during the Civil War, when the government famously conducted assassinations, arbitrary arrests, and was torturing people in prison. So the last time I was there, last May, you know, old women were stopping me and saying, you know, what can I do? They've taken away my grandson and I don't know where they're keeping him. The government gives me no information and he's never had a hearing. So conditions were already that way in El Salvador, and 80,000 civilians in El Salvador had been rounded up under this state of exception. So I think Bukele's move to say, to offer to play this same role for the United States is really in keeping with his history.
All right, let me reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. We are talking about the state of immigration and immigrant communities in Illinois, 3 months into an administration that has taken significant action on immigration, going beyond, apparently, the confines of the law, at least as many courts have seen it, and that includes sending hundreds of migrants to El Salvador without due process. We are going to continue this conversation after a break. My guests for this are Miranda Hallett from the University of Dayton, Fred Tsao with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, Adriana Cardona Magidad with WBEZ in Chicago, she's a reporter there, and Charlotte Alvarez, Executive Director of the Immigration Projects, which serves immigrant communities in downstate Illinois. If you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455, especially if maybe if you are an immigrant yourself or you know an immigrant, you're willing to speak out. We'd love to hear from you about how you are feeling at this time. Again, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking about immigration for the rest of the program today, particularly what the Trump administration has done, you know, arresting people off the street, sending hundreds of migrants to El Salvador without due process. Several Democratic politicians have traveled to El Salvador to try to meet with some of their constituents in detainment. Student visas have been revoked. As I said, some students have been detained by ICE. Even tourists have been caught up in this. And in his meeting last week with the El Salvadoran president, Trump suggested this could go beyond immigrants, as reported by NBC's Today Show.
We also have homegrown criminals. I'd like to include them in the group of people to get them out of the country, but you'll have to be looking at the laws on that.
Before the meeting, Trump can be heard on a live stream shared by the Salvadoran president's team. Trump telling Bukele he may need more prisons.
Homegrowns are next. The homegrowns, you got to build about five more places.
We're talking about how all this is affecting immigrants in Illinois with Miranda Hallett, Associate Professor of Cultural Anthropology and Director of Human Rights Studies at the University of Dayton in Ohio. Also Charlotte Alvarez, Executive Director of the Immigration Project in Bloomington Normal. Fred Tsao, Senior Policy Counsel for the Immigration, for the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. And Adriana Cardona Magidad, immigration reporter at WBEZ, the public radio station in Chicago. You can join us at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Charlotte, let me come back to you. If the administration wants to remove a migrant from the United States, how is that supposed to work?
So it's supposed to work through a due process system through administrative courts, called the immigration courts. There are some individuals who are subject to expedited removal, meaning that doesn't have to go through the immigration court system. But in previous administrations, that has been interpreted narrowly. So, for example, people who just arrived at the border and have been in the country for a short time and have not expressed a fear of return. But everyone else is supposed to go through our immigration court system. And that system, as Fred said, is really backlogged right now. But immigration law is really complicated, is second to the only to the tax code in complication. And so it needs to have an adjudicator where we can look at each individual case and the circumstances of that individual's status and history to determine whether that person has a right to remain or an option for legal status in the United States or is ordered removed and taken out of the United States.
Fred, let's dig a little deeper on this due process idea because, I mean, it is supposed to be guaranteed under the Constitution, never mind that Trump said earlier this week on social media, quote, we cannot give everyone a trial because to do so would take, without exaggeration, 200 years, end quote. Talk about the significance of due process when it comes to immigration proceedings.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. The right to due process is guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. It's in the Fifth Amendment that nobody can be deprived of life, liberty, or, you know, or property without due process of law. This applies not just to the criminal context, which is usually where we think of due process, but also to, you know, all manner of other contexts, and that includes specifically immigration. I always think back to a former immigration judge who noted that immigration courts are, are basically making, they're considering death penalty cases in a traffic court situation. These are very, very, very high stakes decisions that can literally be a matter of life and death. If someone faces persecution or torture, if they're deported, or even if they're going to be separated from U.S. citizen family members, spouses, children, that can have really dire consequences, not just for the family, but for the entire community. So due process, the ability to make your case in front of a neutral decision maker to contest the various accusations that are being leveled against you, or for that matter, to be able to claim various forms of humanitarian protection or other forms of relief that are allowed under immigration law is vitally, vitally important. And, to the extent that this administration is trying to short circuit all of that, to try to scare people into deporting themselves, to engage in self-deportation, or find other ways such as Charlotte mentioned, expanding expedited removal or invoking the Alien Enemies Act, which we've seen with respect to the people deported to El Salvador. That's a very, very troubling development that we have not seen under previous administrations. And fortunately, there are any number of different core challenges that are being leveled against these changes, quite a number of which so far have been successful.
And Miranda Hallett, let's be clear about this. Why do these rights even apply if you are not a citizen of the United States?
Due process is necessary to determine who is a citizen, for one thing. So, due process is for all people, for everyone, from the innocent to the guilty, because it's the only way all the facts can come to light and a decision can be made carefully that complies with the law. It may not be perfect. We know that our systems are not absolutely perfect, but it's the best we have. And it's certainly better than flouting those systems. One of the things that I've been really interested in El Salvador is how is it that democratic backsliding and authoritarian moves have been so acceptable to the public? Why is it so popular, right? How are people convinced essentially to give up their rights and democracy? And my conclusion is that it happens through cultural discourse of dehumanization and that really spurs a moral panic giving an exaggerated view of a threat to the public by a specific social group, often a stigmatized or marginalized group. So over the course of about 20 years, because it wasn't just Bukele, his previous administrations as well, kind of convinced Salvadoran people that all young people in poor communities were gang members, and all gang members were a fundamental existential threat, and all of them were irredeemable terrorists who simply could not be rehabilitated. And if you look at the spectacle that Bukele likes to put forward of people in chains with shaved heads, packed in like sardines, surrounded by masked officers in black and decked out like SWAT teams, these are obviously not necessary in a highly controlled prison environment. They're part of a spectacle that produces a sense that these are bad dudes, right? These are all super dangerous people. But when you look at the numbers and you look at the data, the investigation's not there. The facts are not there. The government is not showing, right, demonstrating. They're not willing to go through a hearing process in order to demonstrate that these people are truly a threat. I just read a human rights report from Cristosal, an organization based in San Salvador, and they were able to find that of the 278 Venezuelans who'd been deported from the U.S. to CICOT, 47% were in the process of seeking asylum. 11% had temporary protected status, which is a humanitarian status that specifically protects against deportation. Only 30%, a minority, had a formal deportation order. And significantly, 87% had no prior criminal charges, much less convictions. But the point is, even if these all were super, guilty, violent people, they still need due process in order to figure that out, right? They still need due process in order to determine that these individuals are a public threat. And beyond that, I mean, transporting people internationally raises a whole host of other questions relative to human rights law. I mean, I would question whether what's been done in this situation, and certainly Bukele's suggestion to then swap these migrants to Venezuela in exchange for others, doesn't somehow constitute human trafficking in international law. I mean, it really is beyond the pale of anything we've seen before.
Let's go to the phones, 800-222-9455. We have Sharon on the line from Kinmundy in southern Illinois. Sharon, thank you for calling in.
Thank you, sir. I'll try to be very brief, but despite the fact that my family, other than my beloved son-in-law, upon whom my husband and I depend upon for support. He's been married to our daughter for 17 years. They have a single, beautiful child who is now 12 years old. And if her status is also in doubt, by the way, because Trump wants to get rid of birthright citizenship, and he may be extending that even to children that only have one foreign parent. We just don't know. And it's living in this state of terror for him, for my daughter, and for my granddaughter. It's, I've sprouted more gray hair in the last few months than I ever had before. That's how people can go through this and be so helpless, and with this terribly, as you've pointed out, accelerated situation in which rights that go back to the Magna Carta, it's older even than our Constitution. How can people sanction this? How can anyone accept this violation of our most basic rights? And we now are living in terror. I'll take my answer over the phone.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sharon. I appreciate that. And Adriana, I want to come back to you because I'm sure you've heard stories like Sharon's again in your reporting. You actually talked with a partner of a Chicago man who had been sent to this prison in El Salvador. What's your understanding? Just talk about what's happened there.
Yeah, so again, last month, the Trump administration flew more than 230 migrants to El Salvador under the claim that these men were dangerous gang members or a threat to national security. Among the people flown there was Jason Rodrigo Jaimez Rincon. He's a Venezuelan man, he's 29 years old, and he lived here in Chicago with his partner for several months, and he was under ICE supervision. He had an ankle monitor. On January 31st, he went to the local immigration office to get that, you know, his monitor checked because the battery was running out, and he was detained instead. He and his partner were communicating via, chat or like phone or video conference. But on March 15, the phone went silent, and that's when the partner realized, okay, maybe something's wrong here. Was he sent to El Salvador? So she started looking, and then she saw a CBS News report with the names of the men, that were listed, and they published that, and she saw his name there. And
She found out from the news. Wow.
Well, yeah, she was panicked, frantically started looking, and then she saw a video posted online that showed the U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, touring the prison. And then his partner's face was right in front, behind bars, facing Noem. And she started crying, freaked out, we conducted a background check on Jaimez Rincon. During the time that he was in Texas and Illinois, we didn't find any criminal record, but his asylum application was denied. He had a deportation order, and the family knew that his deportation would happen anytime. They just didn't realize and question why was he sent to a maximum security prison in El Salvador, just like that. He does have tattoos, and the tattoos have been kind of like this indicator by the current administration that people, if they have crowns or if they have stars, they may be connected to Tren de Aragua. It's a it's a dangerous gang that originated in Venezuela. But a lot of experts say these are unreliable indicators. So Jaimez Rincon had tattoos. He had like two stars on his shoulder, the name of an aunt who raised him, a crown on his chest with his daughter's name, which signifies that she's his queen. And other reports from NPR have said that ICE officials said that they're not only relying on tattoos, but still it's very questionable.
Yeah, well, a lot of questions, more questions than answers, unfortunately, at this time. And that is where we are going to have to leave our conversation today because we are out of time on the program. Adriana Cardona, Maggie Dodd, Charlotte Alvarez, Fred Sow, and Miranda Hallett, thank you so much for being with us to talk through this today on the 21st Show. We will cover this issue again in the future. Thanks to those who called in. We appreciate that. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.